Hello, I'm Dan.
I'm JJ.
And we are the Men Who Explain Miracles. Welcome back to The Men Who Explain Miracles, a podcast about impossible crime fiction. This month, we are doing something a little bit unique in the world of locked room mysteries and impossible crimes. We are talking about an author who is still actually living, which is pretty amazing stuff.
At time of recording.
At the time of recording, yeah. Hopefully this isn't an omen of some kind.
God.
But we are going to be talking about the man, the myth, the French author Paul Holter.
Obviously, we will be discussing the translated works of Paul Holter, since neither Dan nor myself read French. You don't read French?
Not yet.
You're not keeping some secret
at
French.
At the time of recording, I don't read French.
Ah, nice. So we will be looking at the works of Paul Holter that have been translated into English by John Pugmire and published under his Locked Room International imprint, which has done so much work bringing a huge number of different international impossible crime novels and short stories to our collective awareness. The works of Paul Holter represent a huge section of this. There are some 12 or 15 titles, I think. I should have counted before we did this. There are some 12 or 15 titles, I believe, that are now available in English, and so these are the ones that we're going to be going through today.
So when it comes to Paul Holter, I haven't read any, and JJ has read too many.
I refuse to believe there's such a thing. But anyway, carry on.
Well, in this episode, JJ is going to try and convince me to read Paul Holter. I don't think I'm going to need much convincing, but we'll see how it goes. Unless you do such a terrible job that I'm just completely put off for the rest of my life.
God, I apologise sincerely to John Pugmire. Everyone's just listening to this going, oh my God, that sounds like trash. Sorry, John.
This author is just awful by the sounds of it.
I'm going to go and read some Gladys Mitchell instead. Yeah.
Well, let's see how we do. First up, for my benefit and for the benefit of the listeners, who on earth is Paul Holter? Tell us a bit about him and where we can position him in the context of Golden Age detective fiction and locked room mysteries.
I mean, Golden Age detective fiction, we can't, because he published his first novel in, I think, 1987.
Okay, yeah.
The Fourth Door was his first book that came out in French in 1987. So obviously we are significantly on from the, even by the most optimistic expansion of dates, yeah. We are no longer in the Golden Age. But a huge amount of what he writes is obviously in that Golden Age tradition. I mentioned in the introduction how Locked Room International have done great work translating so many other foreign authors. We've seen some of the classic era, of the Golden Age era authors in the French tradition. Three Noël Vendry books have been translated, for instance. A lot of people will have read Gaston Leroux's The Mystery of the Yellow Room. And what Holter does is, I think he takes that very classical Gallic tradition where everything is, there's that slight element of alacrity, that almost sensationalism in elements of it, and tempers it with a slightly more, Western, but I'd say with a slightly more English sort of reserve. Most of his books are set in England.
That's interesting.
He's an Anglophile in the same way that Carr was, and of course we're going to end up talking about John Dixon Carr at some point.
Yeah.
So what Holter does is he takes that pre-existing Gallic tradition of puzzle plotting and updates it using the same classic era English form of puzzle plotting and marries the two very, very nicely. He just happens to be doing it 40-odd years after the Golden Age ended.
So obviously, publishing in the 80s to begin with, and he's still alive and writing now. Does he have new work coming out? Is he regularly publishing work?
The last few years, he has published a couple of stories in Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine. One of them in particular, called The Yellow Book, is absolutely fantastic. And he hasn't written a novel, I think, since about 2014, but it was announced recently on his website that he will have a new book coming out in 2019. I am very excited. Mm. It's his first genuinely new, not just a translation of something that was originally published in the 90s, but something that hasn't been even published yet. And my understanding is that it's coming out in English before it's coming out in French as well.
Wow,
it's
okay. Going
to be called, I believe it's called The Golden Watch. It's possibly already my most anticipated book of 2019.
Exciting. Put that on your Christmas list. Now, of course, we've already mentioned the great John Dixon car, as we tend to do in almost every episode of The Men Who Explain Miracles somehow. If you don't know who John Dixon Carr is, he was a prolific writer of impossible crimes and lottery and mystery fiction. And there's often this catchphrase that's kind of used to describe Holter, which is that he kind of took on the mantle of Carr. As if, you know, he's kind of Carr reborn or the modern Carr. What do you think about that? I always am slightly sceptical about those kind of catchphrases. It's the same like way that the Agatha Christie is used to pretty much sell every book. You know, her name has so much power, it drives sales. When you say the modern Agatha Christie, or even better than Agatha Christie, and you often find that's not the case at all. How much is this taking on the mantle of Carr phrase helpful for understanding Holter, and do you think it's true?
I think I can understand where it has come from, because Carr traded so heavily in impossibilities. We know, obviously, that not everything he wrote was an impossible crime, but he did write more than a few. He is referred to in many places as, you know, the king of the impossible crime, in the same way that Freeman Wills Cross was the king of the unbreakable alibi, and Gladys Mitchell was the queen of turgid, awful prose and horrible characters. So it is...
Can't wait for the comment section now.
So I can see it in that perspective. Additionally, they are both authors who were non-native to England, where they set most of their works. Now, Carr actually lived in England for a time. I don't think Holter ever has, but Carr at least lived in England and did quite a lot of his writing while he was in England, and left and came back and left and came back and left, depending on the changes of government. So I can see it from the perspective of, first of all, they trade very, very, very heavily in impossibilities. They are both foreigners writing about an English ideal in detective fiction of a particular era. A lot of Holter's stuff is set in the era when we were getting the best out of Carr in the 1930s, into the early 1940s, I think. Some of it is set even earlier, like the late 19th century. There's a couple of books that come much earlier. Tellingly, I think it's, you made an excellent point about how Agatha Christie's name is used to push so much in terms of sales, where Christie is very well known. There is a lot of general awareness in just society. Carr is not anywhere close to as imprint as Christie, and so Carr's name isn't going to carry that same sort of import. If you say to 9 out of 10 people on the street, Paul Holter is the new John Dixon Carr, then they go, are you okay, mate?
Cross over the road.
are you sure you're okay?
There's that guy running around saying that phrase again.
So I think actually it goes a little bit deeper, in that this is probably the sort of thing that's not just a marketing soundbite in order to get people to buy books.
That's fair.
I think it's something which a lot of people, having read Carr, would go into Holter with a slightly cynical twist of the mouth of, oh, so this is, you know, this guy's the new Carr,
right,
as well.
Right.
We'll see about that. And so I think if you're telling people this is the new John Dixon Carr, or this is the guy who's adopted the mantle of John Dixon Carr, you're saying that, or the people who are going to follow up on that, that's going to mean something to them. And so simply being not of English origin and trading heavily in impossible crimes, I don't think is going to be enough. I think what both Holter and Carr bring and brought to the impossible crime novel and the impossible crime short story is a tremendous ingenuity, a real inventiveness. And if you consider Carr created some quite staggeringly original stuff in the 1930s, which is 80 years ago now, which is terrifying. It's been 80 years since The Burning Court was published.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely mental. And in that time, a lot of people have come and written impossible crime novels, and there's been a lot of stuff going on. And even after all of that additional innovation, Holter is someone who brings a huge amount of originality, a huge amount of insight, and has introduced a whole new level of innovation into the way he creates impossible crimes. Not everything is completely new. I can take, I don't know, like the central trick in Death Invites You, for instance, is not new. But the way it's phrased and the way it's framed and the way things are put around it make it feel like a slightly fresher take. And there's almost a kind of a, with that title in particular, there's almost like a self-parodying postmodern element to it. The way he dresses it up inside of this slightly more inventive setup. and he has written a couple of quite breathtakingly original impossibilities. The man being pushed out of the window by an invisible man in The Demon of Dartmoor is incredibly famous in sort of the Holterite circles, and rightly so, because it's ingenious. It's so, so, so clever. And it's something which a lot of people have had 80, 90, 100 years to do, and no one has quite thought of it. And then Paul Holter has found this niche. And so he's not just recycling and rephrasing and reboxing existing old tricks. He's actually working in a huge amount of real insight into the history of the genre. You know, he's read his car, he's read his Noel Vondry, he's read his Gaston Leroux, he's read his Anthony Boucher, he's read whoever else, all of the classics. He probably, you know, doubtless read Christiana Brand, and I'm struggling to think of other people who wrote Impossible Crimes in any kind of quantity. But he'll have read all of that and is still trying to forge something new, and is still able to find new and interesting takes on it, which I think is where the car comparison becomes decidedly more meaningful.
That's really helpful. And I think when we've gone over Carr's works in the past, the ones that have always stuck out to me are those ones where it's a totally left-field take on a problem, or setting up something that should be a ridiculous and convoluted context, but is handled so well that it makes sense, so therefore a ludicrous impossibility is so satisfying because of the context built around it.
Mm, I mean, there's the Paul Holter short story collection that's been published in English, The Night of the Wolf. The title story in that just is a genius piece of how you commit a no footprints murder. It's a really savagely smart updating of something which has been around for the best part of 100 years. I actually think Holter's no footprints stuff is actually among his most creative work, and some of the stuff that shows him off to be best. I am a huge fan of a no footprints impossibility. Mm. But even like, you can even see in his short fiction, you don't have to work through the novels. That short fiction collection is incredibly high standard stuff all the way through. And they're not all breathtakingly original, but they all show a real, I'm trying to think of the word I want, like, he's a real agility of mind to come up with this situation and then resolve it in this incredibly intelligent way.
So that's interesting. So you've got a balance between ingenuity, new ideas, fresh ideas, but also Holter, from what you're saying, is able to take a classic problem and provide a new solution or a fresh take on it. Mm. That's really interesting as well.
We're both huge fans of Jonathan Creek. One of my least favourite episodes of Jonathan Creek is it The Eye of Tiresias, mm-hmm. where you've got the old woman having the prophetic dreams.
One of my favourites, that one.
Definitely. we shall agree. Robin is and I have been disagreeing about what makes a good Jonathan Creek episode of late, so it's fine. I accept that I'm wrong and everybody else is right.
But it kind of, it always depends on when you watched it.
Well, this is, this is very true.
Anyway, we're going to go off piece, but yes. So, Eyes of Tiresias. Yes.
I am not a fan of The Eye of Tiresias because I just think the prophetic dream thing is really hokey, and it's like astral projection problems where you go, well, it's either he's got a twin or there's some trick with time because someone's in jail and they're also somewhere else. The prophetic dream thing, it just feels a little bit hoary, and it just feels like it's really difficult to come up with anything that actually feels like it will work. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there is a Paul Holter short story called The Cleaver, which is about a prophetic dream.
Mm.
And it's amazing.
Okay,
it is one of the best impossible crime short stories I've ever read.
And what makes the difference?
Because of how workable and how unique to the setup the situation is. What I like about it is that a lot of times with the number of pieces you have to move around in an impossible crime novel, sometimes you come out of something feeling that the author is very clever. What I like about The Cleaver in particular is you come out of it feeling like there is a particular character in there who is very clever. And obviously it is because the author is very clever. But it's the kind of thing that I got to the end of and sat back and went, yeah, that was smart. Like, that is somebody being very, very smart in a particular situation to enable a possibility, mm-hmm. which is a different, like, I like that seizing of an opportunity rather than some sort of complicated 87,000 piece machination. Right. And there will probably be comments, people will accuse Holter of complicated 87,000 piece machinations. Right. And I don't deny there are some of them in some of his work. But I love the way that he takes these lovely simple steps, I suppose, inside of situations, and just converts very cannily through very intelligent schemes on the parts of his criminals, rather than it relying on accident, or rather than it relying on luck, or rather than it relying on a very conveniently inattentive protagonist who happens to not see the key thing. There is a lot in there which is just very smart use of a very particular situation. And I think this is partly something that Holter gets accused of, and partly something the Impossible Crime gets accused of, where people say, oh, it's unrealistic, because what are the chances of that happening?
Right.
With my perspective on the Impossible Crime has been, well, no, because that happened, somebody then sees that opportunity to make an impossible crime.
Yeah, sure.
Which is always seemed to me to be the way around to look at it, because someone recognises how unlikely a situation is to then be able to exploit it.
Of course.
And I think there are elements of that exploitation throughout. Like they run so deep throughout Holter's work. I won't deny, as I say, that there are sometimes he has a few too many moving parts. Sometimes he doesn't have enough moving parts. But this is a guy who's written, you know, I don't even know how many stories and how many novels. I think the Wikipedia page says something like, you know, over 30 novels.
Mm-hmm.
They're not all impossible crime novels, and they're not all going to be as brilliant as each other. But there's still a huge amount in there where he is really cleanly coming up with these very intelligent ways to manipulate a situation, and to do so in a way that is still original 100 plus years into a subgenre.
Not easy to do at all.
Mm.
And that's interesting that therefore there's a balance in, okay, we've got, again, ingenious, new, fresh ideas on the impossibility. We've got updated versions of classic problems. But also, as you're saying, that means if the context around them works as well, it's not just the problems that are good with Holter. It must be also the motivations, the opportune moments that people take, the way that you know, that sometimes it's said there's only a few reasons why an impossibility would occur. So fresh angles on that is really difficult to do as well. So that's really exciting to hear.
Mm. It's also nice that he, you know, he will go out of his way to not make life easy for himself sometimes, just to provide like a maximum level of entertainment. Like I always, whenever I read his books, I always have this picture of him in my head of him just sort of sat at his computer going, yeah, that'll be fun. You know,
let's make it happen.
Let's yeah. try and make an entire street disappear. That'll be fun.
Which is very Carrian, I always feel. Because that, like I said, when we were talking about he wouldn't kill patients, it's like he was at a zoo and was like, let's do one here. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like, or let's bring all the trappings of this context into an impossible crime. Why not?
Yeah.
And yeah, that feels like a very Carrian tool, you know, to go a completely mad direction.
Yeah, and I think that's incredible to see that. I mean, I have said several times I've come up with an idea for an impossible crime novel that occurred to me out of just some reading that I was doing.
Nice.
I'm never going to be able to turn it into anything. And I think it must be great. That's even more impressive to be able to go, oh yeah, I can do this. And then to just go away and just have a really rip-snorting time just writing it up.
Yeah.
Like, sure. I think there's a risk we want to take everything really seriously. Whereas actually, sometimes it's just fun. Aren't we here to enjoy ourselves?
Yeah. Well, when you read these books, do you get a sense of that? Because that's interesting. I'd always seen Paul Holter as, maybe for that reason, oh, it's serious impossibilities. I know it's kind of about the play on the macabre and things like that, and how you balance humour. But do you think you find, as you're reading Holter, he's having a good time as well as the reader?
Yes, in short, yeah. I think it's all about how much fun he can have, because you get novels like, I am a huge fan of his novel The Invisible Circle, which was once described by somebody on my blog as impossible crime for Terry Pratchett fans, which
okay,
is
right.
just, it's this, it's bonkers.
Yeah.
And it's not even trying to convince you that it's plausible. It's just, it's just him getting a bunch of people in this weird old castle, naming them all after people in Arthurian legend, and then locking a man halfway up a tower, an isolated tower, overlooking the sea. They seal the door with wax, they press a coin into it so they know that no one's going to be able to get in. He's got the Holy Grail in the room with him, and they come back half an hour later, no one's gone up the stairs, and he's stabbed to death by Excalibur, and there's no way that it could have got through the mesh on the window. It's just this ridiculous just scaling up of... And I, the man is just sat there cackling and just working away and just having so much fun. Even when you take away the impossibilities, the seventh hypothesis has two, I would argue, fairly minor impossibilities. One is the impossible appearance of a body, and one is the impossible disappearance of a body.
Nice.
They're very small elements of the plot. It twists and twists and twists and twists and twists. And there's just this extended section in the middle where it's just... Oh no, now it's different. Oh no, now it's different. Oh no, now it's different. And none of it's based around the impossibility. It's just playing around with how much you can subvert the reader's expectations inside of a narrative. And you don't write that kind of a book unless you just want to have a bit of fun with it. Mm. Death Invites You is a man who is found murdered in his study, locked in, but he is an author of impossible crime novels, who is in the middle of writing a book in which the main character is murdered in the way that he himself is found murdered.
Brilliant.
And he hasn't finished writing the novel, so they don't know how it was done in the book. So they've got to solve it in the real world of this book. There's just that additional layering of it. You know, not all of them are this sort of hell for leather kind of, you know, foot to the floor, just go straight for it, over the top craziness. But there is always this idea of just trying to put, or there's usually this idea of just trying to push what is possible and just trying to push the settings a bit more. And I know people might argue that that's the window dressing, but I mean, everything around impossible crime is the window dressing. That's the point. It's how you dress it up. We call them impossible crimes, but if you got to the end of an impossible crime novel and the detective went, yeah, it can't be done, it's actually impossible, that'd be a fucking riot. Like, we want it to be rational. If you just write it entirely unadorned and you show the wires and you show the mirrors and you show the secret doorways, or you show the fact that there are two doors into a room and one of them's bricked up or whatever else, and you don't put any adornments around it at all, it's just a story of something that happens in a way that's explained. So obviously there has to be set dressing around it to make it appear impossible in the first place. That's part of the beauty of when something is really simple. If you explain that defenestration of the Demon of Dartmoor from a very slightly different perspective, it's a really obvious thing. But the whole point is you sell it in a particular way. You put it in a context where there's a headless horseman riding around on Dartmoor, and there's already been, you know, the evidence of people being pushed from great heights by an invisible demon, and so you're setting up this world where these things are possible. Arguably those two elements of that book are not hugely successful, but they contribute towards what makes the impossible being shoved out of a window as successful as it is. You know, this is why I keep reading them. Yes, there are flaws in every book, and of course there are flaws in every author's work, but fundamentally it is that joy. It is, I am going to make an entire passage disappear. It is, I am going to stab a man in the middle of a snowdrift without there being any footprints near him. It is, I'm going to lock somebody in a room, and then when we come back to that room, not only is there a dead body in there, but it's not the dead body of the man who was locked in there in the first place. Like, it's all of that fun. It's all of that just, how much can I push this? How much creativity, how much sort of what Rococo flourishes can I bring to this?
Yeah.
So that it gets more intriguing, it gets more exciting.
And it's interesting that there seems to be, as you're saying, a canny self-awareness and a postmodern flourish in that as well, where, like, the book inside the book inside the book idea, that's just brilliant, you know, like, and I haven't even read it, obviously, but I'm already drawn in because of the window dressing, as you said, the idea that you can play with those things. But it can't all be sunshine and rainbows, can it, for Holter? What are the criticisms around his work? As you said, every author has, you know, their difficulties, and as audience members, we all have different likes and dislikes. Mm. What are the kind of criticisms that Holter generally receives, and what do you make of them?
I mean, the first unavoidable thing is that a lot of people do not like his characters. They do not feel that they exist as people with any sort of independent thought or form. They are very much pieces to be moved around. I think there are books where this is more true than others. I think there are times he tends to try to overstuff. So The Seven Wonders of Crime is a very, it's an astonishingly, it's a brilliantly ambitious book in the sense that he tries to commit seven murders, seven impossible murders, each based around the seven wonders of the ancient world. Which is...
Oh my gosh.
But like, it's even before you get to that, it's stuff like the killer sends paintings to the police warning them of the crimes. And so there are these paintings, and stuff has been painted on top of the paintings that sort of form the clues in advance of the killings.
Lovely.
Which is this superbly esoteric touch. But the book is about 160 pages long or something, so you've got to try and get seven impossible murders, these weird painting sort of messages, then you've got to set up the people involved in those murders, then you've got to actually execute them, investigate them, and then you've got to resolve them.
Yeah.
And it needs to be probably three times. I would love it if it was three times as long, but it should really be three times as long to do justice to all of the different elements of it. And there are times when I feel he gets very excited trying... This is, again, that thing about having so much joy in what he does. I feel like he gets very excited trying to get in all these different ideas. And sometimes it comes off very well. The Tiger's Head, which is ostensibly about a man who is beaten half to death by a genie, comes out of a magical artifact, as you do, is superbly constructive. The Madman's Room, which was translated fairly recently, I think has received near universal, if not actually across the board, universal praise for how staggeringly tightly constructed it is. Mm. And it's an astonishing piece of plotting. It's really quite phenomenal. The Seventh Hypothesis, again, there are a lot of moving pieces in there, but they come together really quite beautifully and they focus around a smaller number of characters. And I think sometimes when there is a bit too much going on, he loses sight of the people. Now, I mean, my account to this is he wouldn't be the first person to do this. You're not going to tell me that everybody writes characters as well as Christiana Brand writes characters.
Right, right.
It's not possible. I've read a moderate wedge of classic detection, mm-hmm. and I'm not going to claim for a second that every single author has managed to do fabulous moving work that sort of created people that feel like they've come into my heart and my soul, and I've taken them upon myself. People might say I'm willing to overlook flaws in character as evinced by my late in life love affair with Freeman Wills Croft, who every man and his dog on the internet is, you know, trying to convince me and you and everybody else that he's a dullard of absolutely zero redeeming features at all. And so maybe I am slightly more tolerant of flaws in character, but nevertheless, let's not pretend for a second that Holzer is the first person who has ever evinced any deficiencies in character work.
And let's not pretend that that's the point of detective fiction either.
Particularly not impossible crime fiction,
exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. I read a really nice comment, and it was on the Golden Age Facebook group, which we're both part of, which is a brilliantly active, wonderful group. If you're not part of it, go and find it. And I can't remember who it was, and I'll comment in the comments if I can find it, but it was a woman on there was saying about, again, how it's this constant comment that all the characters are cardboard or cut out, blah, 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 but that actually, because of the nature of detective fiction, we don't get inside people's heads in, like, she thought to herself, was that the, etc., etc., unless we say follow the detective.
Mm.
So we rarely get that immersive experience into the emotional life of someone because of the idea of misdirection and that we're having to hide that. And so it's I don't think it's always fair, and this is a bigger discussion maybe for another episode, to say, oh, detective fiction's characters are bad, blah, 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 etc., etc., when it's not the point of the type of storytelling that is being done in detective fiction at all. And as you say, as you rightly say, particularly in impossible crimes as well.
It's very interesting because it depends entirely what you as a reader want to get out of it. We would love every book to have characters as rich as in Christiana Brand's Tour de Force, which is, I personally don't rate as a book, but I can't deny has some fantastic characters.
Absolutely.
Or you'd love to feel the characters as strongly as you do in Christiana Brand's The Crooked Wreath, or suddenly it has residence, as it's known. So detective fiction can do good characters. It is possible to create good characters in the detective fiction milieu.
Absolutely.
And we shouldn't say, well, because it's detective fiction, it's obviously it's acceptable for the characters to be terrible.
Yeah, and we have no expectation or forget about it. Yeah.
There's the very famous comment made when Lord Peter Wimsey is crying the morning that a criminal he has caught is being sent to be executed, that if he has that much trouble with what he does, then maybe he should get another job. Like, there's a certain amount of insight that is perhaps over-egging the pudding and is perhaps moving on from what we're looking for.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't dismiss flaws in character. At the same time,
we've got to know our context, haven't we?
Yeah.
I mean, when you move into noir, we want to expect more character, but that's because that's what it is.
This is very true.
Sci-fi will bring a different thing, yeah, as well as other contemporary fiction of all types. But it's the tendency to want to box in, which we all fall into the trap of, which makes it happen.
Mm.
So, to finish then, why should someone read Paul Holter?
There's a huge amount of recycling in current crime fiction, where a lot of current trends see a shocking child murderer unmasked in the final pages, which is great, but those of us who know our detective fiction know that this happened in the 30s or in the 40s or in the 50s. I've just read, or tried to read a book that gives away, it's a modern thriller that gives away what's actually what would be an amazing mid-book reveal on the cover.
Oh, man.
Yeah. There's a huge amount of recycling in current crime fiction from old detective fiction, which is why a lot of us who are snobs, and I count myself among them about this, tend to avoid crime fiction because we feel like it's done better and it's done in a more pure way in classic era detective fiction. Impossible crimes are then equally culpable, I suppose, of this sort of shortfall, where there are some fairly classic tropes that are just recycled and recycled and recycled. For Holter, there is that tremendous creativity, where I think a lot of people who are into their detective fiction, to their classic detective fiction, like that slightly pell-mell, helter-skelter, slightly unpredictable aspect to them that you're never entirely sure quite what's going on. As much as there are tropes inside of it, That idea of being caught off guard by something that has been magnificently hidden, that's been just kind of beautifully palmed right in front of you, which I think impossible crimes have to work even harder to do, because they're not just trying to hide a killer, they're trying to hide a method. And Holter is primarily going to appeal, I think, on like the first level of appeal is going to be someone who feels like they've read it all in classic era detective impossible crime fiction and doesn't think there's anything new under the sun. But on top of that, much broader than that, just to see how to actually do something beautifully creatively, how to drop a reveal in, actually into the text of the book, in context, in story, rather than putting it on the cover of the book and making it like the very first page. Here's a thing that's going to be a big shock to somebody in 680 pages, but you, the reader, know. I personally find that really tiresome. I think we've lost that desire to be patient, to actually learn to be surprised by things. And Holter is, outside of the specialism inside of Impossible Crimes, he is just extremely good at giving you a surprise and giving you a really barreling narrative on the way to that surprise. So it's not turgid. They're very crisp. They're very spry. Yeah, his phrasing's not perfect. And yes, obviously, I'm reading it in translation, and so I don't know what it's like in the original French and all of that, but they're really spry, they're really crisp, they're really easy to read, and they contain some fabulous surprises, and they're written by someone who knows their detective fiction and is very much working inside of the restrictions of trying to give you something new rather than just reheating microwave food. If that tired kind of stuff doesn't appeal to you, and I don't think it does to anybody, Paul Holter.
Well, thanks very much, JJ. I think I'm just about beginning to be convinced that I should maybe give Paul Holter a try.
It's taking you bloody long enough.
And join us next time, listeners, for part two, where JJ's going to talk us through specifically the best Paul Holter books that he thinks are the best ways to get us started.